This podcast is part of the Red 5 Network. For more Red 5 Network podcasts, visit red5network.com.
On this week's show, we're talking about Hawkeye episodes 1 and 2. We're going to talk about some Ghostbusters Afterlife spoilers, and we're also going to discuss the three-act structure in film. Hello there, Adam.
Hi, Josh.
Hello there to everybody listening. We thank you so much for listening to us. And this is episode 106.
I don't have any fun quips for that.
Me neither. So we're just going to move on. Go for it. What have you been up to this week?
Well, I'm going to recommend something. I'm pretty sure I talked about this on the show like a while ago. But I've been watching a lot of Mystery Science Theater 3000 the last few days, starting on Thanksgiving Day. Actually, I think it started the night before. But they usually do an annual Turkey Day marathon, and on Thanksgiving Day, where some channel, I don't know what TV channel actually does that anymore. It might be Sci-Fi, or even if they're on a TV channel anymore. But they also did this on, I believe, YouTube and Pluto TV, and I was watching on Pluto TV. Which, by the way, that's kind of like a secondary recommendation. I actually kind of like Pluto TV. It's totally free and set up kind of like a, you know, cable where it has a guide and a list of channels and stuff like that. And it's all 100% free. They have a couple channels that I really like, including a Bond channel that runs, I think it's like 21 of the Bond movies or 18, something like that. Like 24/7. It's like back-to-back-to-back Bond. And they also have a channel for Mystery Science Theater 3000 and one for Rift Tracks. Rift Tracks is kind of a leader company started by some of the guys that did Mystery Science Theater 3000 in its later days. After that went off the air, was canceled, they kind of did their own thing for a while, and then they started up a company called Rift Tracks, which is the same thing. And if you're not familiar with any of this, what Mystery Science Theater 3000 is basically, like, let's say, like, 80s movies and before, and these are usually B or C movies. They're usually pretty rough around the edges. And the premise of the show is that in the earlier days, it's Joel and his two robots, Tom Servo and Crow. And they're kind of held prisoner by an evil scientist, and his evil scheme is to make them watch bad movies as experiments. Later, a guy named Mike Nelson takes over that role and still stays on with Crow and Tom Servo as the robot's puppets. And so it's basically the thing. They watch bad movies and they make fun of them as they watch them. And if you've ever seen, you know, kind of that image of, you know, like this old movie, and then down at the bottom there's a silhouette of movie theater seats, and then on the right hand side there's three seats taken up, one by human, and then two puppets. That's Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's maybe a little bit of an acquired comedy taste, I think, but it's really, really funny, and I've been having a blast watching it. Rift Tracks is also interesting because what they do, they don't just do old movies, they do old movies, but they also sell like MP3 audio commentary tracks, more or less, for even popular movies, including Star Wars, Lord of the Rings. They do Marvel stuff, where basically you start the movie and then you play the MP3 at the same time, and then you can kind of listen to their commentary as you're watching the movie, which is kind of cool. But yeah, that's kind of what I've been doing. That's my recommendation for the week, is kind of both of those in the same idea, riffing on movies.
Cool. Thanks for that one.
And you know, they do poke fun of a lot of stuff, but they also do this out of kind of a love for film. Yeah, it would be hard to do this without having some type of love for movies. And so there's this kind of dynamic where, you know, are they making fun of it, or are they, you know, they're actually kind of boosting the signal of these movies that wouldn't get boosted otherwise, you know, putting them on cable or putting them out where, you know, they're pretty much dead other than that. You know, so it's kind of a mix of both. You know, they poke fun a lot, but, you know, they also kind of amplify the signal of these movies. So if you take the recommendation of the beginning of the show where it kind of says, you know, sit down and turn your lights out, it kind of feels like you're sitting in a theater with some friends and, you know, just kind of laughing and poking fun at what's happening on screen. So it's good stuff.
That's a cool. It's an interesting concept.
Yeah, it's a cool idea. Yeah, it's a cool concept.
For me this week, I have to recommend King Richard, which is on HBO Max,
if you haven't.
It's really good. I think it's definitely an Oscar contender in a few categories. You know, I would certainly put it in the Best Picture conversation. I would, you know, acting, supporting actor, you know, those types of things as well. I was impressed by it. It was very moving story about the Williams sisters, Serena and Venus, but also about their father, and who is, you know, King Richard. And Will Smith just nails it. I mean, he's just such a good actor, and he really puts it on display here with all the different aspects of this character. And I think Bernthal, who was in The Walking Dead, he played Shane. I think he deserves the Best Supporting Actor nomination for the role that he played as the girl's tennis coach. I forget what his character's name was, but it's a really good movie. I highly recommend it. I do think it's going to be up for some awards potentially. I really, really enjoyed it. That would be my recommendation.
I have to give that a shot soon.
And with our recommendations out of the way, we're actually going to talk about last week's One Question to Rule Them All.
One question to rule them all.
On last week's show, we talked about all the Ghostbusters films, and we asked the question, which is your favorite Ghostbusters movie? And we gave our answers last week on the show. Ours was for both of us, it was the first Ghostbusters. Has that changed at all since you saw Afterlife?
No, but man, I loved Afterlife.
It's close.
Yeah, I said on Twitter. I mean, I said on Twitter, I don't see any reason why someday Afterlife couldn't take that number one spot after some, you know, more rewatches and, you know, time passes and all that stuff. It's a really strong movie for me.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta agree. I'm excited. We're gonna talk about some Afterlife spoilers here in just a second. Yeah. The results on Twitter were, well, we got to keep in mind there were only 21 votes.
Yeah.
So the original Ghostbusters won with 81%, and then
not surprising there.
No, that was not surprising. But then it was a little
after that
that Ghostbusters 2016 and Ghostbusters Afterlife split
tied. Why?
It tied 9.5% of the vote each. I don't know.
Hey, if you love 2016 that much, I'm happy for you. But
yeah, it's all good.
Yep.
It's all good. We appreciate your opinion, your perspective, and your point of view. I'm not going to lie. I got to be honest. I was a little surprised.
I was surprised how that shook out.
Yeah, so interesting. Let's get into a discussion about Afterlife spoilers.
Yeah.
And I had to start by just talking about, you know, I really had to hold back last week with my non-spoiler view. So I want to now's a chance to really talk about this for real. So what were your thoughts on the cast, both the new characters and returning characters?
There's not a weak spot, you know? Mm. Everyone was strong. McKenna Grace was incredible standout star for me of the whole movie was McKenna Grace.
Agreed.
That character, Phoebe, I mean, I know what you meant by the slow burn now, but, you know, that character, Phoebe.
It's good, though.
It's good. Yeah. But, I mean,
it's a good slow burn.
We all knew what was coming, right? I mean, it wasn't, I don't think it was hidden, you know? It was pretty easy to, you know, to figure out that whole thing. Just the way she played her character, it felt so much like Egon. You know, it was such a spot on representation of what Egon's granddaughter would be, you know?
And, yeah, I totally believed that she was his granddaughter.
Like I told you, I wouldn't be surprised if McKenna Grace had Harold Ramis' blood in her somewhere, you know? I mean, if it's like a distant relative or something, because it felt so natural, her stepping into that Spangler family. You know, I want to mention Paul Rudd, because I thought Paul Rudd was, you know, whereas I think 2016 kind of gets trampled by who's playing who in that movie a little bit, maybe a lot. I don't think Paul Rudd overshone his role at all. You know, I think he was right in his wheelhouse in that role. You know, brought some of the science aspects to it that we're used to from Ghostbusters, and then still brought some physical comedy relief. You know, it was kind of a mix of some characters that we've known before, you know, and you know, our friend Brian pointed out when he saw it, they did the, you know, the whole Rick Moranis thing when he was, you know, possessed, you know, even down to the little waddle run. And he did it all really well, and it wasn't like telecasted. It was all, you know, it all just fit. Nothing for me at least felt out of place.
Agree. I thought he was the perfect key master.
Definitely.
But before he became that, like, yeah, he just, his comedic timing is really good, as always. I always enjoy Paul Rudd. And he can play both, can have kind of a serious side, but he can also obviously has the comedy side nailed down as well. I really enjoyed his performance.
Agreed.
But like you said, I enjoyed all of the performances.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't mentioned Finn Wolfhard.
Wolfhard did a great job. Yeah. I loved his character
too. All the kids were great. All the kids were great.
A podcast.
Yeah.
Delivered a lot of funny moments.
Oh yeah, definitely. And, yeah, know, between podcast and, you know, his one-liners and McKenna Grace and her, you know, kind of jokes that she threw out.
Her jokes,
You know, kind of the jokes were great because they were kind of more reserved comedy. They're kind of like the dad joke type thing, and it all just worked really well.
Felt like it fit into that dry humor of the Ghostbusters, the original Ghostbusters and everything. I thought it fit into that comedy well.
And, you know, we haven't, I mean, like, the returning characters, I thought were, I almost thought that Bill Murray was going to be saved for something post-credits, you know, because it was going on, and we saw Dan Aykroyd, we heard from Dan Aykroyd, but we didn't hear from Bill Murray until, you know, that very, you know, that climax moment. And I thought that was perfectly done. You know, it didn't lean too heavily on them. It let the new team shine, but then the old guys, when they came back in, you know, kind of save the day, or, you know, at least lend assistance. It fit too.
Yeah, I agree. I thought, first of all, Ernie Hudson looks great. I mean, he doesn't even age. Look like he's aged that much. It's just amazing.
Speaking of the One Ring.
And he must be wearing the One Ring. He looked great, and of course I just love seeing all the guys back. And what really moved me, what really floored me, what really impressed me was what they were able to do with Egon's character being a ghost. And it was so convincing. It looked so good.
The CGI was incredible.
Get over it. Yeah, it was so good.
Yeah.
So that was,
I was
great
starting to wonder if we were,
all four of them, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I was starting to wonder if we were going to see him on screen. You know, they did the whole thing with the lamp, and then you knew that was kind of Egon. speaking, you know, from the afterlife, you know, then you do get to see him, and it looks really good. It looked really good.
Yeah, and we even kind of commented after this movie, like, we wish this would have happened in Star Wars, you know?
Yeah, I was just thinking about taking a couple of digs at Star Wars.
Yeah, Luke, Leia, yep. Lando, Han, all together, you know?
And for the CGI, really too. I mean, you gotta say, the CGI here was way better than the Luke CGI that we got in Mando, even though I loved that moment. Definitely better than what we got, you know, out of that. And it's frustrating that, you know, the Ghostbusters can get back together when one of them is literally dead, and Star Wars couldn't do that when they had all three alive. And that's
right. Yeah,
you know, that's kind of annoying.
It's a little bit depressing if you think about it. I don't think I was that sad about it until I saw this movie.
Yeah,
and then I was like, oh, this is what they could have done.
Yeah, right. No, exactly.
I think it made me more sad.
Yeah.
No, they did a great job, and I need to mention, I think it's Carrie Coon who played, you know, Phoebe and Finn's character's mother.
Yeah, yeah.
But she did a great job too. Absolutely. I thought she was perfect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't want to forget about her.
No, she, you know, agreed. She did a great job.
Oh, we both love the cast. About the this is one point for me that I think I have to deduct a little bit compared to the originals. Like, me, the music and the score, I want to talk about the score, because the score, while I love it, literally just steals from, you know, the past movies, from the originals, you know, which is cool. Like, I think it worked here. There is some original stuff mixed in there for sure. And it sort of take the old themes and rearrange them, or, you know, have a different arrangement of them in places, which was cool. But I don't feel like it would, you know, especially like the music that the first two films featured, the Ray Parker Jr. song, and there's a song in Ghostbusters 2. I'm trying to think of who it was. Bobby Brown, I think it was. Those songs to me were so iconic, and just like, I didn't really feel any of that in this movie with the music that was outside of the score, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the score for me was a little, I liked it. Some parts of it were a little distracting, I think. You know, some of it almost felt a little cheesy, even. Thinking of it, like, some of, like, I don't know how to describe it. You know, kind of like that whole ghosty, that type stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know what that would be called. Cam isn't here, or he could tell me. But some of that I felt was a little distracting. I actually kind of was good with the music. It's hard to, I think it would be hard to have written any type of original music that could have kind of competed maybe with some of that iconic stuff from back then. So maybe just kind of leaning on, you know, what's that phrase, dancing with the one that brought you, or something like that.
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah. So maybe kind of doing that type of thing, I think might've been an okay move. The Ray Parker Jr. song was used well. You know, overall, I think I was mostly pretty okay with the music.
I was fine with it. And I even enjoyed the kind of way they reused a lot of the original stuff. It just didn't, like, do anything stood out to me too much, I guess is what I'll say. It didn't, which is fine, but I just remember, like, one of the things I remember about Ghostbusters is the music in it, is the songs.
Sure, yeah.
You know? So that's one area.
I mean, you got that, which was kind of cool. I was okay, you know, just getting the Ghostbusters song, I think.
We had that, and let's get in a little bit to the story / plot, however you want to put it. So basically, what we have here is, we know McKenna Grace, her character Phoebe, and Finn's character, who I can't think of what his name is right now, but basically their family moves in to Egon's farmhouse that he kind of left farm. Behind. Yeah, the dirt farm. He's the dirt farmer. Which was kind of cool how we found out later on what that meant, the trap that he was creating. But you know, we basically have this plot where they're inheriting this. They're out of money. They can't pay their rent. They're inheriting this farmhouse. They start to discover all of the Ghostbusters artifacts. You know, the PKE meter, the suits, the everything, the car. You know, yeah. And so I loved that. What it did was it brought us into the family, the Spangler family. They chose to carry it on that way. They didn't choose to have like the old Ghostbusters train in a new group of goofballs and they become the new Ghostbusters. They chose to take the family and that be the story.
Yeah.
And the family discovering who Egon was and who the Ghostbusters are.
Trevor was cool. Finn Wolfhard's character, by the way.
Yeah. They also relied and they really leaned on Gozer story and which was cool.
I was a little surprised by that. It felt a little bit rehashy for me, but I mean, but all in all, I thought it worked really well. I thought it was good.
Even though it was a rehash, I thought it worked really well, and they made it make sense because with the Evo, I forget what his last name is. He was like constructed Dana's apartment area, and it was like sort of a place, sort of a magnet, if you will, for ghost spiritual activity and stuff like that. But then he also basically created the Somerville place too.
That was cool idea.
Having it so all tied it kind of tied. Yeah, I like how it tied into Evo. I can't remember his last
name. J.K. Simmons.
J.K. Simmons character, Evo Shandor, something like that. I probably just made that up. I thought that was cool. I liked how it leaned into that. And then, you know, of course, so with that, have the return of like the Keymaster and the Gatekeeper and those things all coming back into the story. And then we get through that, we get to see the mini Stave Puff Marshmallow Men and everything and all the spiritual activity taking place in the town. So I really liked where they took the story and the plot, that they chose focus on these younger kids inheriting all this stuff. And then they also chose to really lean into the Gozer storyline and needing to get the band back together to help them at the end.
Yeah.
So, liked it.
Yeah, and I will say, and we'll probably talk about this more later, but you know, if or when there would be a sequel to this, I do hope that Viggo isn't the bad guy.
Right, yeah.
I hope that it would be time for someone new, but we'll see.
I think they would probably go in a different direction at this point.
You know, maybe it's kind of a Star Wars thing where it kind of needs to lean on the classic nostalgia stuff. You know, it's kind of like what Force Awakens did.
I think it really worked for me. I think it worked for
2016. I think, you know, maybe it kind of needed that nostalgia heavy reset.
I think that's why Force Awakens works so well for fans. It's why this movie works so well for fans too, because it's original, it has new characters, it's fresh, but it leans into the mythology, it leans into like the familiar beats of the original, you know. Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
And looking at some Easter eggs, there's plenty of them, and it actually is Evo Shandor Mining Company.
Yes.
The Somerville history leans into that whole thing. The architect of the building that was just in the first Ghostbusters, you know, and Somerville was all built by Shandor and everything too. So that's part of the Easter egg I wanted to mention. Also, the Revelation 6:12 scripture callback. So this was cool because one of my favorite moments from the original Ghostbusters is when Ray and Winston are in the car and they're talking about end times, basically. They're talking about this scripture from Revelation, and Ray says, "And I looked, and as he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became as black as sackcloth, and the moon became as blood." Winston says, "And the seas boiled, and skies fell." I just love the mood of that scene, and the way they're talking about the maybe the dead are rising from the grave, maybe the scripture's coming true. I really like that. It's one of my favorite scenes, and I like how they used that scripture again, and it was basically pasted all in front of the farm, you know, the the farmhouse and everything. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, I agree.
I'll just name a few more here. There was a Zool statue on Egon's desk when Phoebe first explores the house and she discovers that statue. I thought another one that I really noticed right away was the book stacking, the way the books were stacked in the house. You know, there was a scene, the first Ghostbusters in the New York Public Library.
Yeah, right.
Where the books are stacked like that. And okay. Murray's Bankman's like, yeah, no human being would stack books like that. and so there's that stack of books in there, which I really noticed and thought was cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, another one was when Phoebe finds Egon's secret underground lab, and there's like a bunch of spores and molds and funguses that Egon collects.
Yeah, very cool.
You know, yeah. So there were a lot of things. I'm trying to if I can spot anything else that really stood out to me. Oh, Egon's Twinkie.
Yes,
Twinkie. Yeah, the Twinkie. There was a Twinkie in the glove box of the car.
Yep.
I mean, I think Ray's occult was a pretty obvious callback.
Yeah.
Josh Gad actually.
Josh Gad. I would have no idea that that was Josh Gad.
He was the voice of the Muncher.
Not even sure why you need to bring on someone like Josh Gad for that character, but hey. Kind of
yeah,
fun.
I don't know.
I do love Muncher, though.
Yeah, for sure.
Kind of miss Slimer a little bit, but I thought Muncher was a pretty awesome character. Also, a really great payoff with him being stuck in the trap and then released, and you know because it's locked in the prison lockup or whatever that would be called. And since
yeah, that
he
was
eats
used
metals,
a great
yeah,
effect.
Yeah, that was used really well.
Yeah, I agree. I love Muncher. I think he's great. Ghostbusters, are you a god joke comes back at the end.
Yes.
And this time Ray says, yes, I
also
am. We're all god.
Also done well, yeah.
That was cool. Those are the main ones I noticed. And that kind of brings us to what we thought about the ending and then the post-credits.
Yes.
So, Adam, do you want to talk about what your take was on the ending?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it ended really well. I like that the Four Herald wasn't saved until after the movie. I liked that it was part of the movie. Gives it more of a spotlight than just putting it at the end, you know. Not that there's anything inherently wrong with that, but I think it gives it a very special place in the film, which I thought was special. So
I think this film was a great tribute to not only the original Ghostbusters, but to Harold Ramis and the Egon character.
They did an amazing job of paying tribute and homage to Harold without making it cheesy or without, you know, cheapening it in any way. Everything was done with an extreme amount of reverence, and you could feel that the whole way through.
Yeah. Loved that. I really, you know, I enjoyed the ending. I thought that it was very, you know, you think about the past Ghostbusters films, they've all included some like huge thing at the end, you know, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, the Statue of Liberty. You know, and even 2016, there was that thing.
Yeah,
but this had a different ending. I mean, this really focused on sort of smaller setting, this farm, this dirt farm, if you will,
right.
Where Egon has constructed, he's made this huge trap, they have to figure out a way to all come together and make it work to finally catch Gozer for good. And so I really liked that. I loved how the characters, the original Ghostbusters, came back in the end and they were all there standing together. I mentioned that earlier. Yep. Love that moment. I love how Kenna, the Phoebe character, really had stood in the spotlight there in the end too, and had a big part to play in that. They all each had their own thing to do. You know, it was a team effort. Oh,
yeah, for sure.
Really liked the ending.
How about some post-credit scenes?
Yeah, so we got two post-credit scenes, and I really liked both of them. The first one featured Sigourney Weaver and Bill Murray.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, a callback to when we first see Bill Murray's Hickman character.
Yeah.
You know, he's sort of a researcher, a scientist, and he's doing this experiment with electric shock where the character, there's a guy and a girl, like college students probably, and they had to guess like what was on the back of the card. You know, was it wavy lines? Was it a circle? Was it a square? What was it? And Peter just keeps zapping the crap out of the dude because he's trying to hook up with this girl. Let's be real. So he just keeps zapping this poor unsuspecting dude who's actually getting some of them right. And even when he gets them right, he's still getting zapped. So, Dana, Dorian Weaver's character, gives him kind of a taste of his own medicine in this scene, which I thought was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
They kind of had fun with that.
Yeah, it was fun.
That was sort of a fun scene. Then after all the credits, you see that the Winston character really has become a really successful businessman, and he has a lot of resources and he has a lot of money, and it seems important to him. I mean, he wanted the car, he wanted to take care of the car, bring it back home, and it turns out that the old firehouse, the Ghostbusters, you know, main area there in the firehouse was not a Starbucks. It was still there.
Yep.
And brings the car into there, and you see the red flashing light on the attainment area, and you know that makes you feel like, okay, there's some more ghosts that we have to deal with, and there's going to be future stories maybe to come from this. So,
yep,
I like that scene too.
Yeah, it definitely sets up the possibility that this isn't the only time we see these characters again. So I'm hoping for more. I think that the team that they've established here is really strong, and I really want to see more of these kids going forward. So hopefully that's the direction that they're heading here.
Yeah, I hope so. I would love to see those characters reprise those roles in
absolutely
a future story, whether that's a series or more films. I'll take either one.
I want more films. I feel like we get so many series nowadays. I want more films. Ghostbusters, for me, feels like a cinematic thing, you know. So I want to see that on the big screen. So I'm rooting for a film.
I think I said after we saw it, I really want it to be Jason Reitman.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if I trust anybody else to do it at this point, and he did such a wonderful job with this one. I kind of hope they do something else. Agreed. It would be him.
Jason Reitman or We Riot.
Or We Riot, yeah. Adam, you didn't get to give this movie a score last week. Do you want to give it a score, or are you just going to leave it at that?
Easy 9 out of 10.
Yeah, I agree. And seeing it a second time, I feel like it's somewhere between 9 and 9.5 for me, actually.
Yeah, that's fair.
It went up a little bit. I love this film. I think it is a great tribute, and just a great film all around. But that pretty much wraps up our spoiler talk for Ghostbusters Afterlife, and we're going to now head into our new segment.
Sold out? Every copy. Tomorrow morning, Spider-Man, page one, with a decent picture this time. Move Conway to page 7.
There's a problem with page
7. Make it page 8 and give him 10% off. Okay. Make it 5%.
I can't be done.
Get out of here!
This is our weekly box office report coming from comingsoon.net. And, you know, Ghostbusters Afterlife did pretty well in its second weekend. And if we look at the five-day totals, the five-day holiday weekend, as it's sometimes called, Encanto earned $40.5 million domestically over that five-day holiday weekend. And Ghostbusters Afterlife came in second with $35.25 million over that five-day total there, bringing its domestic total to $87.8 million. So, looks like Ghostbusters and Encanto kind of split the family audience there.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't got this. I really want to see Encanto. Yeah, that's respectable for Ghostbusters in week two. I'd be interested to look back and see what other movies have done in their second week, but I feel like that's a pretty good second week for movies as of late.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't have a significant drop as some of the other films have had. So that's good news, and hopefully word of mouth and everything can allow it to continue to perform well.
Speaking of word of mouth, I want to really quick mention on Rotten Tomatoes that it's crazy that the critic score is 63% on this movie.
It is.
Versus,
I don't understand that.
Versus an audience score of 95%.
Yeah, I don't know what... Maybe, and sometimes critics will not review films that lean into the original.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of the Lion, the most recent Lion King.
Okay.
Critics did not review that favorably. But audiences loved it generally.
Right.
And it did very, the audience score was very high. It was basically kind of a repeat of, you know.
Yeah, it really was. It was almost shot for shot in a lot of ways.
So I'm wondering if because this film really leaned into the original. Yeah, if maybe that's why it didn't fare so well. But that's just me speculating.
Could be. But then it's weird because I don't feel like I have to go back and remember. I don't feel like Force Awakens had that happen, even though it really leaned into the Death Star story and stuff like that.
It was
pretty high, I believe.
It was high for critics and
users,
audience, yeah.
Who knows? You never can tell.
I don't know. I really don't understand it, and I felt it should have been higher, but that's just me.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
We also had House of Gucci that opened this past weekend. It earned $14.2 million over its first 3 days, $21.8 million over the five-day holiday weekend.
Heard good things about it. Got to be honest, it's not one that I'm going to watch.
So, I mean, I might watch it, you know, on streaming or something like that whenever it comes out. I'm more interested in other things that are out right now, I guess, is what I'll say. Yeah, that's pretty much that's the box office report for this week, and we're gonna move into talking about Dune again. Now, I this weekend, you know, I had it off for Thanksgiving. You know, I had some days off, and I was trying to find Dune on HBO Max, and it wasn't there anymore. So, I must have forgot that it's only there for like a month, then it goes away. So. Now waiting for like the physical release of it, and we got some news on that, and it will be released on digital platforms on December 3rd, and then a 4K Blu-ray and DVD release on January 11th. I don't know why there's such a lengthy period of time between digital and physical release, but there you have it. December 3rd, digital.
I feel like digital is just a higher profit margin, you know, so it's trying to almost force people to buy digital, you know?
Yeah, pretty much.
Because you're not paying publishing costs and printing it on DVDs, which is like pennies for them, probably. But, you know, then shipping and all the logistics stuff, where you don't really have as much of that at all on digital. So I feel like they make a little more money, so they're going to try to lean into that more.
That's a good point. Didn't really think about that. But I do know there's going to be a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff. There's going to be looks at the different houses, like House Atreides, House Harkonnen, mm-hmm. the Fremen. A lot of, you know, special features, looking inside the training room, the spice harvester, the Sardaukar battle. They constructed the ornithopters, which were like the helicopter type craft that they used, designing the sandworm. So there's a whole lot of behind the scenes stuff, which would be cool to look at. In other news, Jurassic World Dominion released about a 5-minute prologue video. Did you see this, Adam?
I did. I don't know how to feel about this, but I did.
Tell you what, I was pretty impressed by it. I think it's beautiful to look at. I mean, you're really looking at all the dinosaurs when they had dominion over the Earth, basically. And mm-hmm. second, I didn't know if we were in the like the present or if we were back in the past. Then it kind of reveals that
we're back.
It was 65 million years ago.
Yeah,
I thought it was a cool look at like how things looked back when the dinosaurs were around. So I thought that was cool, and kind of leaning into that might happen again unless something happens to prevent that in this film. It does lead into the present of what's going to take place in this third film, and we get a look at kind of like this classic drive-in movie theater, and you know, a T-Rex shows up and all hell breaks loose. So looking forward to this, you know.
I am too. I mean, I'm always going to go to a Jurassic Park movie. The Jurassic World movies haven't been like extremely strong for me, especially after the second one, so maybe not quite as hyped. Yeah. You know, but and especially getting Laura Dern and Sam Neill and Jeff Goldblum back. I mean, that's fun. So mm-hmm. can't complain at that. I'll definitely be there for it.
Yeah, and that'll be hitting theaters on June 10th, 2022. The next story to me was just shocking. And there's a couple reasons I wanted to talk about this. One reason is because I actually started watching Squid Game just the other night. And have you seen it, Adam?
Nope.
Okay, so I gotta say, it's disturbing, but it really pulled me in. I was really intrigued by it, and I wanted to keep watching it. I watched like a couple episodes. This story is just crazy. So apparently, a man who smuggled copies of Squid Game into North Korea has been sentenced to death, according to a report from Radio Free Asia. And this report notes that the man smuggled the series in from China on USB flash drives. He then sold them to various students. According to sources close to the Radio Free Asia report, the smuggler faces death by firing squad, with the students involved in watching the series also facing harsh penalties. Six others who watched the show have been sentenced to 5 years hard labor. Teachers and school administrators have been fired and faced banishment, work in remote mines, or themselves. I don't know what to say about this. I think what's interesting is at the end of this article, it says, North Korean propaganda site, and I can't really pronounce it, called the series, I'm guessing Squid Game, Sad Reality of a Beastly South Korean Society and Proof of the Hell-like Horror of a Capitalist Society. So I thought that was ironic, because you're talking about capitalist society being a hell-like horror. Someone from your type of society is being killed just for bringing it into the country. That seems more like hell to me.
Yeah. I mean, without getting extremely political here, I think all you need to know is that this comes as a violation of North Korea's Elimination of Reactionary Thought and Culture Act. I mean, if that doesn't tell you everything you need to know, that pretty much sums it up, I think. Mm. It's scary that there are countries and establishments in this world with that much power over over their people. But
and what their people consume as far as entertainment and even the way they think and cultural beliefs and different things like that. So I think there's a lot of people out there that should be Thanksgiving just passed. I think we ought to be more thankful than we are for the country that we live in and our ability to really choose what we watch, what we believe, what we worship, you know, those things. So just a little bit of reminder of that.
It's a good way to lighten it up.
Yeah.
So anyway, how about that Hawkeye?
So we got the debut of Hawkeye episodes 1 and 2 this past Wednesday. Adam, what did you think about the start of this series?
I loved it. I thought it was great. I thought Haley Steinfeld was awesome. I think she's a great hero. I loved the humor in it. I thought it was excellent. You know, there's the family aspects for Clint there, which I think are very strong. I love the espionage type feel to this show. I think that's kind of different for Marvel. It felt Bondish in a lot of ways. Even the title sequences, the opening title sequences, which I loved. I loved the art style in that opening title sequence. Felt kind of Bondish. And, that didn't really go away throughout most of, at least the first episode, some of the second episode. I really enjoyed this. I thought it was a lot of fun.
I agree. I think it got off to a really good start. I love how we see Kate as a child, and it's during 2012, and she's in New York. The whole thing with the Chitauri invasion happens in the Avengers, and she sees Hawkeye, and he just becomes her hero. You know, he becomes this person that she's modeling herself after, and she's looking up to, and then she gets to meet him in person, and it kind of goes in a different way, probably from what she thinks. Sometimes when we meet our heroes, that happens, but I love their banter. I love their back and forth. I love that they already have great chemistry. So I'm thinking of Haley Steinfeld and Jeremy Renner. You know, they have great chemistry. I enjoy their banter and their relationship already. Love how it all got set up in the beginning, and it really does have that espionage feel to it. And for a lot of things away, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on underneath all of this. You know, we have the tracksuit mafia,
yeah,
which is an interesting group.
Yeah. I kind of feel like they're going to take care of them and then move on to something bigger after that, but maybe I'm wrong.
I've been wondering if the Yelena character is going to come into this at all, because, you know, her next target is supposed to be Clint.
Right.
And, the end credit scene of Black Widow we saw. So I wonder if that'll come into play.
Yeah, for sure. I can kind of see them taking care of the tracksuit gang in the next episode and, you know, having something else. Like you said, maybe Yelena and kind of be, you know, have the tracksuit as the mini boss and then Yelena as the main boss.
Yeah. I can see that. And, you know, I really liked how they played around with the Ronin character as well, and that suit and everything. And
I loved that Clint's wife knows about that, you know, that wasn't something he was doing in the shadows. You know, I was kind of wondering if that was going to be a storyline, you know, where his family was going to find out the things that he did that was less than savory, you know.
Yeah.
But it's you know, kind of refreshing how honest he is and how much of a, how great of a relationship is portrayed between those two, you know? They really feel like a total team there. That's pretty cool.
I like you said, about how it leans into the family stuff. I like that because, you know, I enjoyed what we saw of that family in the films, but we don't get to really dig too deep into it. And now we're getting, you know, with a series, you can do that. And you can dig a little deeper into their family lives and the repercussions and how that family dynamic works and everything. So, like that, I really like the Christmas feel, because we haven't had like a Marvel Christmas type story since I think maybe Iron Man 3.
Yeah, I was going to say Iron Man 3 wasn't Christmassy enough for you.
Yeah. So it's, I like it. I like this. Yeah, and I like that it feels, it kind of has that. It's not like at all like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, but it has that sort of gotta get home by Christmas thing to it.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Which I really like too. It sets this timetable up, this timeline. Okay, we got like 5 days to get this done so we can get to home for Christmas.
I gotta say, I'm a little worried about Clint. This feels like a story where he doesn't make it home for Christmas.
Oh no, no, he's gonna make it. He's gonna make it.
I would really hate to see that not happen.
Make it, man.
Okay, all right. I'm with you.
Despair.
You'll have to take care of me if he doesn't make it. You promised me. You promised me that he was gonna make it.
A counselor.
All right.
Work through it together. But anyway, you know, I really also like how I like a few things that happened in the second episode. I thought the whole fencing scene between Jack, who is Kate's mom's boyfriend or fiance or husband, I don't know at this point. He's something. That was a really tense scene where Haley Steinfeld's character, Kate Bishop, is really trying to interrogate him in a way and get to the bottom of what is his connection to this. I don't even remember the character that died at the black market, the whole black market exchange thing.
I forget his name too, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. She's trying to just figure out what's going on here.
Right.
So I thought that fencing scene was a great device to try to build that tension and
another one of those Bond type scenes for me.
And then I also really loved when Clint had to participate
in the LARP thing.
Yeah, the live action what was it called?
Yeah, live action role play.
LARP. It was so fun. It was great. I loved that moment.
It was definitely really good stuff.
There's definitely been some funny moments, some enjoyable things. I'm interested in seeing where it's going to go. I'm going to stay tuned for sure. And I don't know how many episodes are in this series. Do you
know? 6. We're already 33% done.
So I'm excited to see what happens next.
Yeah, same here.
At this point, we are going to move into our, what feels like maybe our second or third main segment of this week's show. And we're going to talk, we're doing three acts today, folks. This is
third act. What we did here. You planned this.
The third act. We're talking about the three-act structure in film.
All right, let's resolve this show, Josh.
Yes, this is our Act 3 resolution. I was going to say something else, but I'm not going to say it now. Anyway, it could be taken in the very wrong way. And
well, now I want to know.
Eventually, we're going to get to the climax, Adam. But that happens in Act 3. But let's rewind a little bit. Let's go back and talk about Act 1. I kind of did a little internet search. Wanted to see what the internet came up with the three acts and what that looks like. First act is sometimes called the setup. Generally, that's where you kind of set up the world. You set up your characters. What is the setting? Where are we? You know, that whole thing. Then the second act is sometimes called the confrontation. And there is what's called a rising action. Takes place there where the protagonist is attempting to solve the problem. They find themselves failing or in worse situations and realizing they don't have the skills yet to solve this problem. Maybe they need some help, or maybe they need extra training, or you know, they need to change in some way, be able to develop enough and grow enough to get to that third act. And that sometimes is called character development or a character arc. Then you get into the third act, and that features the resolution of the story and its subplots. The climax is the scene in which the main tensions of the story are brought to their most intense point, and leaves the protagonist and other characters with a new sense of who they are. So that is, in essence, the bare bones, the act structure. And I wanted to just make it simple today. Simply look at the three-act structure and what it is. And looking at another website, there are some questions that are asked, and this is actually coming from nofilmschool.com. Maybe this person didn't go to film school. I don't know. Anyway, there are kind of some essential questions from each act. The first act should answer the question, where are we? When are we? Who are we? Theme, the suspense. Then the second act focuses on maybe the goal. There's maybe a certain time lock, like there's a certain amount of time in which they have to reach this goal.
This is our MacGuffin act.
Yeah, the MacGuffin. It also introduces like the subplot, which could be also called the B story.
Okay.
So your supporting characters, and
not the Jerry Seinfeld movie, right?
No. let's take Ghostbusters Afterlife, for instance.
Yeah.
So the A story obviously is following like Phoebe and podcast mainly in the beginning, and their discovery of Ghostbusters and everything, but our subplot could be like Rudd's character, Gruberson or something like that.
Yeah, I believe so.
Carrie Coon's character, the mom, and they're kind of developing their own relationship, and they're eating together at that restaurant, and they become the keymaster. It's kind of like the subplot. And then there also might be some hurdles in the second act that the characters have to overcome. So they might face some challenges. As you get into Act 3, Act 3 should start at basically the lowest point for the characters, where they failed, there's some kind of maybe loss involved, they have reached their lowest point, and they're trying to cope with that loss. Now they have to figure out, how do we do this now? How do we, so again, sticking with Afterlife, let's think about how they lost the car. They lost their equipment.
Okay.
Carrie Coon's character and Paul Rudd's character have become dogs. They're possessed. They're out of the picture.
Okay.
How do we get the car back? How do we get the equipment? How do we get the help we need to solve this conflict?
Okay.
Then climax is kind of like, they reach that utmost point of that, and maybe they win, or what is, and then the final scene. So that's basically the three act structure. So
I want to ask a question here before we move on. Since you brought up kind of how to identify the transition between Act 2 and Act 3, with where the characters are at their lowest point, versus kind of recovering from that, how would you identify the transition between Act 1 and 2? Is there a way?
Well, there's something that's called the first turning point.
Okay.
So it's the protagonist's attempt to resolve the problem initiated by the first turning point, only to find themselves in a worsening situation. So I guess it's where I'm going to talk a little bit about the Fellowship of the Ring, actually.
Yeah, sure.
And I think that'll a good example of how you kind of tell where that is. So why don't I just go ahead and get into that a little bit?
Okay.
I wanted to look at some films that kind of successfully implement the three-act structure, and The Fellowship of the Ring really came to mind. And there's a ton of others too that we could look at if we wanted to, but let's consider The Fellowship of the Ring, Act 1 being that setup, mm-hmm. and the main characters and exposition are established. We're introduced to the hobbits, introduced to Bilbo first, and Gandalf. rest of the hobbits. We get to know them. We get to know kind of where they're from. We're in the Shire, you know. Right. Exposition about, you know, the history of the Shire, mm-hmm. about what hobbits are. You know, first we kind of discover the ring. We don't know exactly what the ring is yet, but we know it's a thing, you know, that's part of the story of Act One. Then we have what's called an inciting incident, Act One, which I believe is Gandalf discovers Bilbo's ring is the One Ring. Rule them all.
Okay.
So after that inciting incident, start getting into Act Two. Because that's where, okay, now we have a mission. Now we have a goal, which is part of that Act Two questions from that one website. You know, what is our goal? Our goal is we need to figure out how to eventually protect this ring and get this ring. And this doesn't, we don't realize this till the second act, but we know we have to take the ring to Mordor.
So for me, then, I would say that Act Two really kind of starts leaving Rivendell. The Council of Elrond is kind of that deciding point where we finally learn that the ring has to go to Mordor, has to be destroyed, and that's the only way to do it.
I feel like that's more like right in the smack dab middle of the story. The Fellowship of the Ring. I think that's part of Act Two. You know, it's in Act Two, but I think Act Two kind of begins almost when they start their journey. You know, they've left the Shire. They start meet Aragorn. They confront the Nazgul. I think that's kind of like the beginning of Act Two.
Okay.
Because they at least know their goal is to get the ring to Rivendell. You know what I mean? Like that's another goal they have. I think that's kind of in my opinion, the start of Act Two. But again, this could be up to interpretation.
Sure.
So what I have is Act Two is the hobbits and Aragorn must confront the Nazgul. They find themselves in need, so they go to Rivendell. They just, you know, they can't do this on their own, basically. Need to get to Rivendell, and the Fellowship is formed. And that's right in the middle of Act Two.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
And then characters confront other dangers and failures on their way. You know, there's the pass of Cahadras or something like that in the mountains where Saruman kind of blocks their way. And if we were looking at the second act in that structure, we could face a roadblock. And that would be one of those roadblocks that our characters have to face, or a failure, that they're stopped on the mountain pass. And then they have to go through the mines of Moria. They confront other evil and other dangers, and they have a loss, and they lose Gandalf, which is kind of their lowest point. I think that brings us into Act Three, because the lowest point the characters get to is the loss of Gandalf and the despair they're feeling for that loss. Now they're trying to figure out, okay, how do we get this ring to Mordor, but we don't have Gandalf? And
right.
I think when we get into Act Three, sort of the resolution of this particular story, and I feel that the climax of Act Three for the Fellowship is Boromir tries to take the ring, and there's this whole conflict going on with the Uruk-hai right after that and everything, and Frodo has to make this decision. He's going to go on his own. You know, he knows what he needs to do. There's this whole confrontation. The Fellowship is broken. Not exactly a happy ending, because we know this story goes on. When you're making film, you know, you could even look at like whole Lord of the Rings story kind of split up into three different parts, you know, maybe six in some cases. But then you can break this one film into three acts as well.
You can lend some of that to Tolkien's strength as a writer as well, you know. And having each of those three novels be actually one intended large book, but three parts, each with its own, you know, very distinct climax you know, all that stuff, pre-climax, climax, and all that stuff. You know, so each of those books, each of those movies, each have their own very, you know, defined three parts. Yeah.
So that's basically the three act structure, just bare bones, and looking at a prime example, a film that has that three act structure. But I think it's an interesting sort of, exercise to, to look at, really look at films and break them down into acts and like all these things. So I think it would be cool to revisit this at some point and think about other films maybe.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, that's structure, kind of, you know? Yeah, yeah, that absolutely. And this is kind of, you know, when I first brought this idea of Film 101 to you, this is kind of what I was thinking of. So this is really cool. I like this segment a lot.
Yeah, so I mean, and I'm trying to think of some films that have really done a nice job of implementing this recently. Afterlife came to mind. Like I said, I kind of went down through that a little bit now.
Yeah.
And Shang-Chi, I think, does an excellent job of following that three-act structure.
Okay.
And I felt like that's one of the film's strengths is they set up the characters really well, and they set up the world. And then they go through that three act structure. And me, you know what I think one thing I mentioned after we saw Eternals was I felt like it really didn't follow a traditional three act structure, which is as a viewer, I had a hard time watching it because it just didn't feel like it had that normal. It didn't feel like it was a normal like structure to it. And so I think sometimes films maybe dangerous to go.
It's hard, especially with I think the time jumping in that made it hard as well.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, anything you wanted to add about the?
No, I really like this. I like to thank you for the work you put into this. That was an awesome, awesome outline and awesome discussion about the three act structure. So thank you.
Absolutely, and I think for homework, everybody out there listening should try to come up with at least one movie you can think of. And how it follows the three, and see if you can break it down into the three acts.
And then call and leave us a voicemail and tell us about it.
Yes, that would be awesome.
Hey, Doc, we better back up. We don't have enough road to get up to 88.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Thank you all for tuning in to episode 106 of From a Certain Point of View. Make sure if you're not subscribed to the podcast already that you do so on your favorite podcast app. If you're on one like Apple Podcasts, let's leave a review. Please do that because it helps us get out to more and more people. We are continuing our watch parties in Discord now that we have Hawkeye. We'll be doing Hawkeye on a weekly basis. And since we don't have a holiday this coming week, we're back to Thursdays at 10 p.m. Eastern. So join us this coming Thursday for episode 3 of Hawkeye. If you're interested in doing that, join the Discord. You can find links to join on our website, which is facpovpodcast.wordpress.com. You can also find that link in the show notes as well. Back to the website, though. You can find all of our show notes on the website. You can also find links to send us questions or topics. There's a few blog articles there as well that we have written over the last 2 years. And if you would like to contact us on our socials, there's links for that as well. Those socials are Instagram and Twitter at CertainPOVPod. Facebook page is From a Certain Point of View. Our email address is CertainPOVPod@gmail.com. And as I mentioned before, you can call and leave us a voicemail. And if you do your homework that we have assigned you, then you can leave us a voicemail at 724-901-1783. And once again, watch a movie and identify the 3X structure in that. Call and leave us a voicemail. Tell us all about it. We'll play it on the show next week. Once again, that's 724-901-1783. Remember that we are part of the Red 5 Network, and you should go check out all of the awesome Red 5 Network podcasts, which you can find at red5network.com and on Twitter at red5network. And if you happen to miss the Parsec Fan Awards, you should go back and check that out on the Red 5 Network YouTube channel, because that was a lot of fun. They aired that on Saturday night, the 27th. It was a lot of fun to watch it live, and it's already the most watched video on the Red 5 Network YouTube channel. So if you missed it, didn't get a chance to check it out, or just want to revisit it, go give the Parsec Fan Awards a watch. It was a lot of fun. You can find me on the internet at TheGauze85 on Twitter and Instagram. You can also catch up with me on my Disney blog at earsgoneby.blog. Josh, where can they find you?
You can find me, as always, on Twitter at JediJarJar1722. And I gotta say, I am looking forward to checking out the Parsec Fan Awards. I didn't get to watch it last night live. So that would be the channel name, Red 5 Network.
Yeah, YouTube. Yeah. Best way to find it is YouTube. Search on YouTube for Red 5 Network.
And speaking of YouTube, we have a YouTube channel. It's called From a Certain Point of View, so make sure you check that out as well. And thank you all for joining us today. Like Adam said, we would love to hear from you if you let us know what your favorite film is that follows that three-act structure. We'd love to hear from you. And as always, we thank you for being here, and everything we said today was true.
From a certain point of view.